The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping. Stamps.com will simplify your postage needs and add valuable time back into your workday so you have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off UPS and USPS. Send invoices, checks, certified mail, packages, and anything else you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. If you sell online, connecting with every major marketplace and shopping cart is easy. Plus, you can schedule package pickups through their dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with Stamps.com's Rate Advisor. Add more flexibility to your workday with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's Stamps.com/program.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is author James Rose. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for inviting me on.
It's my pleasure, my pleasure. Well, it was easy to invite you on because you've written a book about my favourite film ever. So that kind of cuts through the crap of all the like reasons for having someone on the show, someone that's written a book. You've written the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the Devil's Advocates look at it. I mean, I didn't realise now till since I invited you on, there are now over 50 Devil's Advocate books, of which I've barely touched the surface. I've read Ben Poole's Saw, Anne Bilson's Let the Right One In, and Callum Waddell's Cannibal Holocaust, as obviously as well as your Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So first off, congratulations on a fantastic book.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about that book in a moment. After that, we will do three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. So, without further ado, let us turn our attention to The Texas Chainsaw Massacre by James Rose. Now, I had a quick look on the interwebs to see how many books there were already about Texas Chainsaw. And many of these actually, I got to about a dozen, many of which have actually come out since your book. There wasn't many before. I mean, there is some, obviously. And there's been many, many comics. So, first and foremost, what drew you to Texas Chainsaw Massacre as the book to do as a Devil's Advocate?
The Devil's Advocate series, fantastic series by John Atkinson, is a really interesting proposition because it asks you to sort of choose a film that you can do a really, really detailed analysis of and really engage with the subject matter. And I'd written a book for John before, for Auteur, my first book, Beyond Hammer, British Horror since 1970. And it just sort of came up, would you be interested in doing one?
Right.
And I gave it a lot of thought. And I kind of wanted to write about a film that I enjoyed. I wanted to write about a film that affected me in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wanted to try and challenge myself a little bit about sort of how can you analyse this film, which potentially might have already been analysed quite a bit because there was a lot of, there is a lot of film theory about it and film analysis about it prior to me writing the book.
Yeah, yeah.
But that often appeared as singular chapters or journal articles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was a combination of things really. And it was the Texas Chainsaw that sort of rose to the top. And I have such sort of fond memories, or perhaps everybody does, lots of fond memories of watching it for the first time, having those very guttural responses to it, and having it percolating in your head for so long, and then having the opportunity to write about it and really start to engage with it in lots of different ways was a real sort of draw, really, to start to think about it, not just as these cannibalistic American men, but also start to think about it in a wider sort of context, and perhaps not so much a socio-political context, but more of a horror film context, and trying to keep in with the spirit of the Devil's Advocate series. So there's quite a lot pulling me towards the series and a lot pulling me towards that film.
I mean, one of the books that famously has many, I think more than one chapter dedicated to it is Carol Glover's Men, Women and Chainsaws, which was, I guess, where my eyes were opened to seeing a film, certainly in social political terms, not just in terms of is this a good horror film or not, which was my only measure at the age of 18. And I think once you begin thinking about what a film is and what it's doing, and I guess it's interesting to look further back even to James Furman and how he responded to it as a because it's worth noting that for us in the UK, this film was banned from 1974 to 1999, which is phenomenal as a piece of censorship from a censor who seemed to make it his personal job to make sure we didn't see this film. I mean, those other films got banned, but they slowly came into existence, and some of them were just plain out trash. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a wonderful piece of cinema, and it's almost like the effectiveness of Texas Chainsaw as a movie on him.
it's really interesting, the whole history of its censorship in the UK, because it got banned, but it didn't get banned almost wholesale. Local councils or local governments could apply for a license and show it. So it was in the sort of like the general sort of public consciousness, it was banned, but you could see it. And certain councils did screen it, but then they were met with protests and sort of lots of sort of problematic public response to actually showing it, in part because of what the general public had been told about this film. And it's interesting because when you start to sort of engage with the BBFC's response to it, they did actively, from what I'd read in my research, they'd actively tried to edit it. They'd actually sort of said, we'll try and get it released. We'll try and certificate it. And they kept watching it, and they decided that they couldn't edit anything out because it wasn't what you were seeing that was the problem.
Yeah.
It's what you were feeling that was the problem. And I think that's such an incredible thing for a film to do, any sort of film, not just a horror film, any sort of film, to be able to stimulate within you such almost like a primitive response of, this is absolutely terrifying. And if you try and put your finger on why it's terrifying, I'm not sure you can, because it just generates in you, slowly but surely, dawns on you that this film is absolutely horrific. But there's not, if we're going to be honest, there's actually perhaps not that much horrific imagery in it. But then, now I've said that, you kind of think, but there is horrific imagery in it. Like the bit with Pam being put on the meat hook. But we don't see it. We don't see that instance. We see a lot of setup, which is that beautiful shot of the camera going underneath the white swing. And it's looking at Pam as a sexual object for a start.
Yeah.
But it's making sure we understand that Pam has no protection on her back whatsoever. She's just bare skin. So when she's lifted up and put on the meat hook, we don't see it. We don't see the meat hook go into a skin.
It's not gory as
now. We just simply see a scream. If I remember correctly, it's sort of like a medium close-up of her screaming and trying to put her hands behind her back to lift herself off the hook. And it's a disturbing image, but it's not gory. It's not graphic. And then it cuts back and sort of pulls away, and we see her boyfriend's body, Kirk, on the kitchen table. And Leatherface sort of cuts his head off, but it's done in such a cartoon way. It's sort of like this constant rotating of a chainsaw, and it's comedic. But in the background, you've still got Pam hanging on a meat hook. So you can start to sort of think, you could kind of cut that, but you can't cut that. And you're losing some of the quality of the impact of the filmmaking. It all becomes this, like it is now for me trying to talk about it. It becomes problematic to try and tease out what you could edit and what you can keep in without losing the sheer quality of filmmaking. I mean, I can't even begin to describe how incredibly well directed it is, but how conversely, it's like a homemade film. It's literally like running around with a 16mm camera. It's such a crazy, crazy moment.
Interesting because you can in thinking about that, thinking about those two comparables, is that it understands the language of cinema so well that it's been, you know, what it does has been copied ever and ever. I mean, as you were talking, I'm thinking of like one of the biggest horror films of recent years, A Quiet Place, and the 6-inch nail sticking up out of the step. You know, that is just exactly the same in the way it's set up. And I mean, obviously, it's not someone being put on it, but certainly what you're imagining happens to that foot when it stands on it is what makes it horrible. There's no gore, there's no blood, not really blood, really. And it's all in Emily Blunt's scream, because we would scream too. Equally, the idea of it, of like the almost like documentary style, you can see in like Gaspar Noé's work, in the way that the film throws you into the picture. You know, you're not allowed to look away, because if you look away, you'll miss something.
It is very much that. I think you've hit the, no pun intended, the nail on the head there with the idea that you can't look away. There is something about it that's magnetic, and you're just kind of looking at it and looking at it. And a bit of you is going, I can't not look away. There's part of a pleasure in watching it, and I'm enjoying not looking away. I'm enjoying being scared. But there's probably another sort of 70% of you saying, I've got to get out of the room now, because this is absolutely relentless. This is absolutely... I mean, that first moment when Leatherface appears and takes out Kirk, it's unexpected, it's terrifying, it's instant. And that, I think the bit for me that really sort of twists it for me is his feet kicking on the wooden board. He's knocked out or killed, and there's this sort of few seconds where everyone's allowed just to take a breath, and then it kicks off again, and Leatherface grabs him and hauls him with so much ease into that dangerous place and slams the metal door shut. And it's just this, it's not perhaps the imagery, it's the sound of that scene that is most terrifying. And perhaps it's the sound of the scene with Pam trying to get off the meat hook. It's not what we're seeing. It's the fact that we're hearing that relentless drone of that chainsaw. And also in the background, the relentless drone of the generator that fuels the house and therefore fuels the horror. It's just like you said, it's fantastic filmmaking.
I guess as well, I guess two things happened in the 80s that sort of changed some of the direction of horror. Like, but if you think about going back, I mean, 75, Jaws is made, which is, you know, just a year later. And the whole thing is about not seeing the shark is where the fear comes from. And then as we get into the early 80s, we get people who are, you know, what Tom Savini's doing with gore. And suddenly it becomes about the trying to get as much gore on screen as you can. Obviously, we've just seen the recent success of the third installment of the Terrifier franchise, which is all about the gore. But what we lost there to a lot of what I see a lot in horror films is they believe there's loads of gore in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and they'll cite it as an influence, and you kind of go, no. I mean, I used to be a music journalist. I used to see people talk about being Sonic Youth or a big influence. I'm going, no, you're just having noisy guitars. That doesn't make Sonic Youth an influence. That just means you don't know what to call it. And I think it's one of the most misread films as an influence that I've ever come across in that sense. I mean, Julie DeCorno is probably one of the few where you can see when she talks about it, she knows why. I'm not saying all filmmakers don't know, but when you see her and you see her films, you can see where the influence of Texas Chainsaw Massacre comes in.
I think that thing about the blood, when I sort of think about it and sort of reflect on it, I think the only actual bit of blood that I can remember, apart from red on the walls and things like that, but that's not necessarily blood, is the drop of blood that comes out of Sally's finger when they nick her finger with a knife.
Hitchhiker,
I think, does it. And they try and feed her thumb to the grandfather. But it's just that notion of like a singular drop of blood somehow is, like you said, is magnified in the cultural consciousness that this film is drenched in the stuff. And it's not. There's hardly... Well, and I guess at the very end, Sally is literally drenched in blood. But having watched it a few times, I'm not sure where that blood's come from, to be quite honest.
No, me neither. Maybe it's in the bookies.
There's so much of it. Where has it come from? But, you know, she's only fallen out of a window, tripped over a few times and scratched herself inside some sort of bramble. But it doesn't warrant the sheer volume of blood that's on her face near the end of the film when she's sort of laughing hysterically at the back of the van.
Now, having chosen to do Texas Chainsaw Massacre and then you go ahead and write the book and you said you wanted to give yourself some room to sort of think of it differently or challenge yourself in terms of how you saw the film, what for you was the biggest discovery you made about Texas Chainsaw that you didn't know before you wrote the book? So what discoveries did the book lead you to about the film? I mean, and this can be purely subjective, obviously.
I think one of the things that kind of struck me was about the fact that it's kind of somewhat preoccupied with circles and circular motion and going round and round and round and round. So sort of like Sally is captured, she escapes, she goes to the garage, and then she's taken back to the space. She jumps out the window and is taken back. There's that fantastic ending shot of Leatherface spinning in this endless circle and disappearing into the burning sort of rising sun, which is also a circle. And then there's the kind of the constant talking of sort of like Pam about her preoccupation with astrology. And she talks about things being in orbit and things being in this circular perpetual motion. So there's something about that which is sort of, it's kind of in the film and it runs throughout the film, but isn't necessarily fully resolved. It's just almost like a stylistic thing or a thematic thing that just this notion of circular motion is going to occur. And if we kind of think about it in a wider sort of context, perhaps that's the ending. We've started with the graveyard and we've gone all the way around in a circle to this story, and it ends with Leatherface spinning in a circle. And it's just going to start again because Leatherface hasn't been captured. His family haven't been exposed. And we know they've done it before because the circle began with them digging up the graves. So we know more than likely that evening, that family is probably going to go out again and dig up some more graves. And so begins the circle. So that, to me, was one of the things that really struck. So I'd never really kind of engaged with it that way, because when you're watching the film, you're absorbed in it and you're frightened by it. When you're analysing it for a book, you're stopping it every 5 minutes and making notes. So that was one of the big things. Not having that occur, that feeling of sort of dread while you're analysing it. But I also was thinking a lot about Freud and the uncanny and how certain things are constantly uncanny in it. So that going back to where you came from is a classic uncanny moment. I've been here before. Well, Sally's been there before, and she knows the second time what's waiting for her. And I guess that's why it's even more horrific, because she's not entering the House of Horrors for the first time. She's going back into it, and what horror is now waiting for her, even though we've seen some pretty grim things go on already. There's that thing about the doubles as well, that we see Franklin and Leatherface are often matched together, but then there's the doubling of Sally and Pam and all of those sort of things going on. There's this, to me, that uncanniness, or what Freud defined as the uncanny, was something to do with where the unease from the film comes from. And again, it's like you were saying a few moments ago, it's not anything particularly gory, horrific. It's something that is like on our periphery. It's almost like the everyday, but it's starting to become something far worse. So that going back again and again, it ups the ante. The fact that we're seeing this sort of doubling taking place is like, where's this going to lead and how's this going to pan out in the wider sort of narrative? So it's always a journey, isn't it, writing a book? It's always a process of discovery, and it kind of bothers me sometimes that when you're asked to pitch things, I want to know what the whole thing is.
Yeah.
I don't know what the whole thing is. And part of the pleasure of writing for me is going off on a tangent and discovering something or finding something out and trying it out in terms of the book or a chapter or perhaps even just a paragraph. It might not necessarily work, but it's that process. So writing, particularly that book, I guess, is about discovering a film that has already been discovered, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
It's not like I'm mining something new. That's already been mined. And I'm looking for it from sort of perhaps my point of view, my sort of perspective, and finding these different things in it. I also thought it was quite gothic, something that, you know, we usually associate the gothic with big mansions, vampires, shadows, darkness, maidens in distress, all of the sort of the classic sort of Anne Radcliffe sort of stuff. But this film is still gothic. It's just that it's set in pure daylight.
It still has the house on the hill, really, doesn't it? It is the place that's remote. It is the place you can't tell anyone you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's the place
where the secrets being kept. And those secrets, through horror or haunting, come to light, and we're sort of exposed to them. But I think that there's a certain creativity again there by sort of saying, I've got this classic sort of genre, gothic, and I'm going to put it in Texas in the daylight in this blisteringly hot sunshine.
Yeah.
And we're going to see everything. When nothing's going to be in shadows, we're going to see everything. And we do.
It's interesting what you're saying about the uncanny, because for me, the uncanny was always about, was sort of that borderline between what's real and what's not, so therefore what becomes supernatural. But there's nothing supernatural about Texas Chainsaw. It's very much about the world gone mad or the world untethered, as much as it is them when you're from the city and you go to somewhere that's not of the city. So I suppose the uncanny here is almost like we've gone back in time to a kind of, you know, you think of TV shows like Deadwood, which is like, you know, the beginning of what becomes American civilization is this kind of the dog eat dog in ultimate form. Well, in a way, and that's where I guess Carol Glover's theory about urban oil comes from, I suppose, is what you're saying is the uncanny. You know, you go you go somewhere and you're no longer in the country you're from, even though you've only traveled 2 hours from the city. You've literally gone back in time or stepped into a different place.
Yeah, but there's a lot to be said about how her ideas about it sort of suggest a temporal sort of distortion, isn't it? Like you said, you're going back. You're going backwards into the backwoods, and there's things have progressed there, but not progressed in the way in which they've progressed for everyone else that has moved sort of forward. And I think you're right, there's something very much about the past in those places. And I guess Texas Chainsaw has it not just in the ancestral house, as you said, is really the replacement Gothic mansion. But there's also the fact there's all those relics around the house, but there's also the relics in the attic. There's grandpa's up there. There's that desiccated female corpse. There's the stuffed dog. These are all things that are from the past and they're not being let go of. Even at the very beginning, if we could perhaps stretch it a bit further, the past is literally dug up and turned into a as it says, a grisly work of art.
Yeah.
Everything is, for that family, entrenched in the past, and perhaps give it some more thought, but in a way, perhaps they're stuck in time. They don't want to progress. They don't want to move forward because for them, progression, as the hitchhiker sort of communicates in the van, particularly to Franklin, has meant they've lost their jobs. Everything's become mechanized. It's made them redundant. They're not needed, quite redundant, literally, and redundant in terms of a wider sense of the word. So for them, being frozen in time and now sort of thinking about it, there's that image of the, because the camera moves through the house, through the back sort of gardens as Pam and Kirk move through it.
Hmm.
There's that image of the pocket watch with the nail driven through it. And there, time has stopped.
Stops time.
Time stopped. They've stopped it. They've driven a nail through it. And that's, I don't know, that's quite an interesting sort of perception about the film and the that idea of going round and round and round in circles. Clock can't if it's got a nail through it.
But also, but thinking about what you're saying there, then you could, there's almost like if you turn it from the young people's point of view to the family's point of view, then to them, progress is horror because it's taken away their livelihood, it's taken away the life they prefer. But they're also saying, I mean, in some senses, they're also saying the mechanized, the industrialized killing of animals isn't natural. It's much more it's much more natural for me to do it one at a time. I'm in touch with that relationship. And if you take that away from us, then suddenly we're just killing en masse. So therefore, killing you makes no difference. I'm not excusing murder here, but it's kind of in the context of the story, maybe that's what's going on. Well, it's a fascinating film, and obviously, like I said at the beginning, it's a film that I love every time I watch it. The book from Devil's Advocate is by James Rose. It is out now, as you get it, as through the publisher Auteur, and that brings us close to that section. And we'll move on to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Okay, James, rules are simple for the three films. You've given me three titles for which I'm going to be asking you to talk about them for 5 minutes with me. At the end of 5 minutes, you will hear this sound. And you can hear that okay at your end?
Yeah, definitely.
Good man. Anything you want to say about what you're going to do in response to the film titles as we go? How have you prepared for today?
I think because I have a propensity to ramble,
okay,
I've prepared a very, very, very short statement that I hope sort of encapsulates why I've chosen these films, and then we can have a nice chat about it.
Brilliant. Okay, that seems reasonable to me. So, first out the gate is the sixth highest grossing movie of 1979 at the British box office. I'm talking about 1978's Watership Down, but it actually should have got released in 78, but because of Jaws 2 and Star Wars getting reissued, they pulled the release date and knocked it back a year. So I've already let the cat out of the bag there. We're talking about Watership Down. Tell us why that film impacted on you.
Okay. I saw this film for the first time when I was quite young. It was at the local cinema, the Ritz, and I don't remember the experience of watching the film, but I do remember that afterwards, my parents took me and my brother to go and get a bag of chips straight after the film. We all sat in complete silence in the chip shop on some red moulded plastic chairs, and we were all somewhat stunned by what we'd seen. So I, like many people of my generation, had a somewhat disturbing first experience with the film. When I was a little older, I would habitually watch the film each Christmas, along with repeated classics of the era, just like Ray Harryhausen's Sinbad films, Zulu or The Great Escape. Part of the reason for selecting this film is one of the three. It's not because of its inherently disturbing aspects, but more so because of its inherently being bound up in my personal history of cinema and the intense feelings of nostalgia that I now associate with it. I'd go on to see Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Back to the Future, Young Sherlock Holmes, The Temple of Doom, Condor Man, Tron, and many, many others at the Ritz, and they would all become the foundation for my understanding of cinema. For me back then, it was a glorious heyday of film for me. And to see films like Watership Down at their point of original release, experiencing a certain sense of unrestrained and possibly experimental cinema, Watership Down is complex in its imagery, spoken in its own language, and imbued with myth and the spectre of the Black Rabbit of Inlay. It is extremely brutal in its violence and in its gore, particularly in the brutal depiction of nature, the instant kill of Violet by the hawk, and then Bigwig seemingly choking to death in the snare, blood and spittle foaming at his mouth, as Fly's circle is soon to be corpse. This film set for me quite early on a very specific way of perceiving nature. But it also suggested to me that horror can be so much more than spraying blood, spilled guts, and a bucket full of gore. It can be terrifying, it can be beautiful, it can be human, and it can be communicated with genuine feeling, all of which was bound up in our personal and wider mythologies.
So first off, for that, before we get into the film, walk me in through the doors of the Ritz. Which Ritz are we going into?
This was the Ritz in Nuneaton. And
okay.
It was, I think it moved.
Running an online business requires passion, knowledge, and a lot of dedication. Adding the complexities of setting up and managing hosting for your website piles on more work when you already have so many plates spinning. Whether you manage one WordPress website or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions give you access to a platform that's optimized for the fastest speed, has enterprise-grade security features, and is powered by an intuitive custom dashboard with everything you need to manage your sites efficiently. Plus, Kinsta provides human-only WordPress expert support, which is available 24/7, 365, to assist with even the most complex sites. Forget frustrating AI chatbots. Kinsta gives you complete peace of mind by ensuring that your WordPress sites are always online, secure, and performing at their best. Start your journey with Kinsta today and get your first month free. Don't have time to migrate your site? Kinsta takes care of everything for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's KINSTA.com/podcast.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling essential prenatal multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a 3-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Originally, was sort of just off, I think, the main area of the town. So you could walk through town and get to it relatively easy. And then as cinema started to sort of decline, it moved to the arts centre. It became incorporated in the arts centre. And I kind of looked at pictures of the cinema in sort of recently and in the past, and I just don't remember it. I must have just been too young to have absorbed
it.
I really remember, because I must have been going to the cinema on my own, I was about 15, 16. I remember when it had moved to the arts centre.
Yeah.
And it was just like this brown, dark, dingy door you walked through. And there was no like fanfare of film like there is now. But then when you finally got up to the sort of the stairs and to the box office, there was the posters and the 10x8 black and white stills and things like that. And it was just like proper cinema up there, but you had to go through this dark, dingy brown door to sort of get into this hidden sort of fantasy world of cinema. So, and I think that's sort of part and parcel to my sort of selection. It's not just about the film, it's about the feelings that I have associated with them and the nostalgia and the personal narratives that go around them.
Yeah, because, I mean, around that time, not long after, you've got Secret of the Nymph and you've got Stray Dogs as well, I think it's called.
Yeah, Plague Dogs.
Plague Dogs.
Yeah.
You know, and looking back, how in God's name did it, A, get certificated as Universal? What was it, just did it as a blind spot for just because it was a cartoon, it was animation? And the fact that it traumatized, I'll finish that thought. The fact that it traumatized a generation, and yet it took more than 30 years for it to move from a U to a PG. Yeah. I mean, like you say, you saw it at the cinema, it was a regular thing in the 80s on TV. Yeah. It was like it had a repeat pattern for traumatizing children. and parents alike, I imagine, as you describe with your silently sat in your plastic chairs wondering what you've just watched. A fantastic choice. Right then, that 5 minutes went fast. So, so let us move on with haste to a film that when director Steven Spielberg first read the novel, he found himself rooting for the shark because the human characters are so unlikable, which is not true of the movie, or not all the characters. I am indeed talking about Jaws from 1975, adapted from Peter Benchley's novel. Do you want to talk about why that has an impact on you and why it holds such fond memories?
Yeah. But Jaws, this is the best, if not the greatest film ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we could talk about the many stories that surround the making of the film, could argue over who wrote the famous Indianapolis speech, and applaud the contributions made by editor Verna Fields. I think it's really important to always recognise how incredibly well-directed and how well-acted this film is. I've watched it countless times, the first being when I was allowed to stay up late and watch the UK terrestrial premiere on ITV on the 8th of October 1981. And like Watership Down, I have very little recollection of that actual experience, but I would watch it again and again and again whenever it was on. I eventually got to see it at the cinema in the around about the early 1990s whilst I was an undergraduate, and it was like seeing it for the first time, particularly the overhead shot in which the shark glides past the orca, and we see for the first time just exactly how big that fish is. I could talk for hours discussing this film, but time doesn't permit it. And I think my respect and admiration for Spielberg's directorial skill is all encapsulated in the scene in which Brody, Hooper and Mayor Vaughan discuss the shark attack in front of the defaced billboard. It's just one long take with pitch-perfect performances and exquisite blocking as the actors move around each other, shifting sides, and so creating triangles of power with the ocean, or more accurately, the shark behind them and slowly breaking into that shape and metaphorically washing up on shore in between the men. Such a simple and eloquent and exceptionally directed scene.
Now, I hadn't thought about this when you give me a list, but now you've been talking and now you've gave me why you like Watership Down. We've got another film which is about the horror of nature. We've got a shark, which is a sociopath because it has no empathy. Something in the sequel it seems to have. It seems to be on a revenge mission. It knows who it's trying to kill. Whereas what we've got is the randomness of nature. But also, it's a film that's held up. I mean, I'm a screenwriter, and it's a film that's held up to have a fantastic screenplay. And one of the reasons it's a fantastic screenplay is the shark isn't the baddie. It's a symptom of the baddie, but the baddie is the mayor of the town.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it an interesting film. Because if it was just about people going in the sea and fighting a shark, that'd be a very short movie. Whereas what we've got is a real drama around the politics of a seaside town.
And I think that there's two sort of worlds to it there, isn't there? There's the first half, which, as you say, Vaughan is the mayor, is the villain. And you've got a very weak police chief who won't stand up to him or hasn't got the confidence to stand up to him. And once we sort of move beyond that point where we've met Quint and we've met Hooper, and then Mayor Vaughan signs off Quint's contract, we then got another film start with the three men on the boat.
Yes.
But it's the same story of Brody coming to terms with who he is and establishing who he is and his masculinity and finding it out. And for me, it's either film about what you said about the corruption that is implicit in that kind of capitalist society, or it's about a man figuring out his own masculinity and going back home with that masculinity. So it's way more complicated than it just a shark eating thing.
Yeah. And also as well, you get the impression that he might have been not feeling like very much a macho man in his urban role, and coming to this seaside town was a chance to have a quiet life. And then the quiet life, he comes up against other dangers. And then the idea that there's this present risk of a shark in the water and nobody but him sees the threat, because the beautiful irony of him being scared of water in the first place is wonderful. You know, not just scared of sharks. he doesn't like water, and yet he's the police chief in a seaside town, which makes it, you know, it's a lovely little bit of detail, which I'm not sure. Have you read the book that it's based on?
I started reading it when I was younger, and I couldn't really engage with it. I think I was probably too young. And I've got a copy. In fact, I've got two copies of it. But I don't want to...
Finish your thought.
I don't want to read it because I just don't want it to... I know it's massively different to the film.
Yeah.
And I know why. But I just don't want another version of Jaws in my life. I know that sounds a bit odd or practically bad. But the version that I sort of grew up with and watched and would watch whenever I could... It's just perfect, and it's kind of, in a way, it feels like don't meet your heroes. It's sort of like I don't want to meet the source. I don't want to meet the original, because the adaptation, perhaps for once, is so good. It's just so powerful, and so it's just a masterclass in filmmaking.
I was going to say, it's a bit like First Blood, isn't it? The source material is just a Pulp Fiction. It's not the greatest piece of work. And there's a lot to be said. If you do see a film first, going back to the source material is not fun, because somebody's decided who somebody is, and
what I did with First Blood. I remember watching that. My parents would always have a sort of VHS double bill on New Year's Eve, and one year we had Poltergeist and First Blood, which was quite a mix. And I loved both of them. First Blood was just amazing. I couldn't believe. It was a Sylvester Stallone film, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
And the anger that you felt against the police, and the fact that they're going out of their way to deliberately annoy this man, and then they arrest him and beat him up and all sorts of stuff. And then he just unleashes this hell upon them and literally turns it into hell, doesn't he? Burns to hell. And then he has that emotional breakdown at the end. And then I read the book and I just thought, yeah, film's massively better than it. Made some good choices there.
Well, weirdly, you mentioned that it was that you saw the ITV premiere of it on terrestrial TV in the UK. Jaws was my first ever feature film to watch on VHS.
Oh, wow.
And First Blood was my first ever pirate video to watch, weirdly, just to be told.
Was it on Betamax, though? That's the thing.
Oh, VHS. I would never forget at Viv and Les's. Les was somebody my dad played football with. They had kids same age as us, so we just went for a sleepover and parents got bladdered. And we watched Top of the Pops on a Friday because they taped it from the Thursday night, which was mind-blowing to me as a child that we could watch it at our leisure. And then everybody watched it. And it's just, being a nostalgia for something that doesn't exist, but I think this does now. In the age of phones and things disrupting, you know, eight people sat down and watched Jaws, and eight people didn't move until Jaws finished.
Yeah.
And it was just one of the most, you know, again, I don't have a vivid memory of anything to do with the film, you know, any moments in the film, but I do take that away from me that you were just mesmerized when the film finished. Mm. You felt like you'd been to the cinema, even though you were in your friend's living room. But yes.
For me, that's where this choice has come from, exactly what you've just said. The films have impacted me and informed me in lots and lots of different ways. But when I was going through the process of thinking about them, they're adjunct in my own personal history of cinema is just as important. And like you said, I think people of our age have gone through such an interesting time in terms of cinema and its movement into home entertainment.
Yeah.
And that whole idea of pirate videos and not being allowed to see and all of those, and censorship being such a big thing with the video nasties and all of that sort of stuff. We went through quite almost like a crucible of cinema, really, in Britain. And that's really sort of informed a whole raft of people. And that's us. And that's, I mean, perhaps even on another level, someone like Edgar Wright and people like that that have then distilled it into actual cinema, and it's gone full circle again. It sort of repeats itself in things like Shaun of the Dead and in Hot Fuzz. We find all of those things. But I think it's really interesting to think about how you first saw a film and what social context it was in. We were saying about Texas Chainsaw. A lot of people probably saw it on a pirate VHS. But the first time I ever actually fully saw it was in a packed cinema in a, a screening where, I don't know if this is a false memory or not, but it, there were so many people in there that wanted to see it that I think people were sat in the stairwell and watching it. And I took a friend with me. My wife wouldn't come with me. And she was too scared. She just didn't want to experience it. So I went with a friend. And I, this is a true, this is a real memory, I'm sure. Is that my friend halfway through just turned around to me and said to me, why have you brought me to see this? That's all he could muster. That was it. That's all he could say in the horror. But I was just, I think it was even more horrifying because the audience's fear just percolated into you and you were just like, you were feeding each other. And, you know, you kind of get that sense, like you were saying, there's eight of you watching Jaws and you don't move. It's that communal experience. It's not perhaps now the singular experience of watching a film and being on your own or watching a film on your phone. It's an entirely different experience. Or streaming something, when you could, you've got it for 48 hours, if you rent it from Amazon, you can stop it whenever you want. You can then pick it when you're on your commute. All of those things have gone. And I think that personal history about cinema is just as important as the impact of the film on you.
Yeah, I was in a think tank discussion while I was in Tallinn recently at the Black Knights Film Festival, and one of the women there was saying they'd done a research report into 7 to 11-year-olds about how they think about film, and they don't think about film. All they see is that there are short videos and there are long videos, and a feature film, as you and I would identify it, is just a longer video to them. Because of that nature of how the context of how they get it on a tablet, they get it on the telly. You know, mum or dad can just stop and start it. You can pick it yourself once you've got the hand of the, you know, the control. But there are just short videos and there are long videos. And there's no, you know, so to them, Jaws or some guy doing a YouTube video throwing meat into the sea to watch sharks eat meat is just a video. It's just, which is frightening, but also, I guess, liberating in the same way, because, you know, you're going to find, if you're interested, you'll still find your way. But I don't know whether or not we'll get, you know, the full attention of everybody. It's why I love film festivals are good for that, because that's where you tend to get an audience that's there to watch a film, or you tend to go to your rep theatres and they tend to be a bit more cinephile friendly, as opposed to your View or your Cineworld, where, you know, people just come to talk on the phone for some reason. I don't understand. But
that's interesting. My wife and I went to see Joker when it first came out, and it was packed, absolutely packed. And I'm not entirely sure the majority, I think, of the audience knew what they were going to see. I think they went to go and see Batman make a celebrity appearance and we'd have some hijinks with this guy called Joker. And there'd be all sorts of criminal activity and there'd be a big fight and you'll get put in prison at the end and all of that sort of thing. And I remember there was a group of girls right at the front. They were talking quite a lot, but so were the groups of lads and families that were in there. And about halfway through, the whole of the cinema was just deadly silent. Just deadly silent. And it was that word deadly, it just sums it up. It was just like an unexpected thing for this to happen, and it was like anything could happen, and it just felt like these people were genuinely scared of what they were seeing. It was like, you're confronting me with a film which shouldn't be in this universe. It's not Batman, it's not superheroes. Where's all the color? Where's all the explosion? You're presenting me with an incredibly ill man is fumbling his way through the world. And now he's got a gun, and now he's shooting people, and now he's doing this, now he's doing that. And I couldn't believe it. There was a lady who sat a couple of seats away from us, and she whispered to her husband, "I am terrified." Just like, wow.
Warner Brothers would love that in the poster.
it was just mad. And I thought, how is this a rare experience now in cinema to be in a communal space and to have people not looking at their phones, not talking to each other, not rustling popcorn cartons, but to actually be 100% invested in this character and to feel so much that you're stunned into this real sort of silence where you're looking at it going, I need this to end because I need to know what happens to this person. Oh, but
that's the best, feeling. That it's the best feeling once the cap has been whipped up from under you and you don't know where it's going. And
that's it. Yeah,
it's the best feeling because that means there are no rules, and if there are no rules, that means I've got to pay attention because I might miss something and not quite get it. Right, sir. Let us move on to your final choice, which is a unique one for me because this is the first time a film's been chosen for the three films where I can say a previous guest has featured in it. I had Nicholas Vince on, who is the Chatterer
in
Clive Barker's horror classic, The Hellraiser from 1987. So please tell us where this fits in with your film memory and why it had impact on you.
Okay. So every weekend, my family would hire a VHS from the local video shop. Clive Barker's Hellraiser was being heavily promoted in spaces like that through lots of posters and cardboard standees of Doug Bradley playing the title character who would eventually become known as Pinhead. His face and pierced body adorned the video box art. For a late teen who was hoping to go to art college, this image was incredibly attractive. It was beautiful, it was disturbing, but most of all, it was original. A juxtaposition of the internal and the external, a hard glistening metal against the soft glistening flesh. I convinced my dad that we absolutely needed to see this film. So one weekend, we hired it out and perhaps mistakenly, we watched it as a family. At about the point in which Frank is reborn from the attic floorboards of the house on Ludovico Street, my mum sort of went quite pale and said to my dad, should the boys be watching this? I became then somewhat obsessed with Clive Barker. I read his collections of short stories, The Books of Blood, and his novella, The Hellbound Heart, upon which Hellraiser is based. I tried to consume as many articles and interviews with him as I could get my hands on. That all led up to the production and the release of his second film, Nightbreed. I was absolutely fascinated by Barker's imagination, context that was compounded by him being British and by how explicitly British his horror was. I began to see as a result of Hellraiser the possibility of horror in the everyday and the everyday of Britain, that the mundane spaces of the UK could be fictional sites of tremendous, creative and original horror. That horror ultimately wasn't an American construct after all, but a global one, and because of Barker, could also be a local one.
It was... definitely for me, it was a terrifying movie. Definitely a VHS experience like yourself. And the box that's the puzzle box, which is the kind of the gateway between our world and the world of the Cenobites, is in horror film terms such a simple setup, isn't it? Because there's just this idea of something from a foreign land. So therefore, I mean, I guess you could argue it's a bit simplistic or maybe perhaps casually xenophobic, because the idea of in them far off flood places where white people don't go, kind of thing. There's these things. So, but then once you've got, but by establishing that, there is no need to explain what happened when the shit it's the fan. There's no need to go into explaining what they are, because it's like you've messed with the box. That was what you were told not to do. So that's it. So it's just consequences. So I'm just thinking from a script writing point of view.
Yeah,
you just roll with it because you're like, yep. I can give you anything. I could have thrown a marzipan cake in your face right now and it won't matter because I said, don't do that, and you've done it.
Exactly. And that's the whole film, isn't it? There's two layers to the film, like with Jaws. You can either take it as that, as a straight sort of horror film in which you are clearly warned about this object, this dangerous object. But I think the beauty of it or the complexity of that object is that it offers you the possibility of infinite pleasure or infinite happiness. And I think there's a certain tragedy to Frank in that respect, in that we're told that Frank's like this hedonist and he wants these deep, deep sort of pleasures. And he doesn't get that. He gets extreme violence sort of inflicted upon him. But in a way, he's also someone that's very, very lonely. He's missing some core sort of value or some sort of core love. He just, there's something about him that's missing that requires that sort of moment of pleasure. And I often sort of think when I watch it that he's not searching for some sort of sexual pleasure, but I think he's searching for something else, some sort of emotional connection, because that is out of his frame of reference. He just can't seem to have them. I mean, he rocks up at his brother's house on the eve of his brother's wedding and sleeps with his, you know, future sister-in-law that's 24 hours away. There must be something wrong with him that he's doing that. But then, like you say, that box is, it just doesn't need explaining. It's just, you know, a box. Open it and hell, in whatever format comes out.
Which, if you pull it right back to that sort of basic building blocks, is the same setup as Gremlins.
Yeah.
Don't feed them after midnight, whatever the thing is. You know, it's sort of, you're just warned that you shouldn't do something, but you're not warned what will happen as a consequence. So once the consequences start unfolding, you're off. Well, look, we have come to the end of three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Thank you for sharing those very personal and specific memories. It's really good. And like you said during the conversation, I think it is, there's the analysis of the film, but then there's the analysis of you in a time in your life, in an opportunity to watch, and all those kind of things that then become part of the story. Like you say, you were saying yourself, I'm not sure if this is a memory I'm making up now or one that really happened. Or, you know, I mean, I think there must be a chorus of parents up and down the country during the 80s who turned to their partners and went, should the kids be watching this? I mean, in our family, our infamous trip to the video shop on one Sunday to get the double bill where we're allowed to pick it. I picked Cannibal Holocaust, my brother picked Life of Brian, and an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old sat down with dad and watched that double bill. And in many ways, that double bill is probably why I'm talking to you now, I could argue. Because
very much so,
because not long after seeing it, it's suddenly on Granada News going, this is polluting the way, you know, children are near. And you're like thinking, we've seen it. And admittedly, I wouldn't advise 11-year-olds to watch. I wouldn't give that as a thing to do. But it didn't turn us into raving lunatics like they were talking about in the news. And I think, and I remember like late 80s with Tom G. Matthews' show, The Censored on Channel 4, which kind of compounded what had gone on from the Video Recording Act. And I didn't really understand government censorship and stuff in terms of horror films and things, but it's, yeah, it all stems from there, like for me. And I find that really interesting. I'm glad you're able to share your stories, and should remind people that Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the Devil's Advocate book series is available now. Are you, before you go, is there anything that you're working on at the moment you can tell us about, or anything you're hoping to get in the works?
I'm currently doing my PhD.
Okay.
So I'm just starting my second year in doing that.
Okay.
I'm doing some other little writing projects around it. I've just done the liner notes for Second Sight's limited edition release of Late Night with the Devil, which if you haven't seen is fabulous, Late Night with the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got lots of little essays and stuff coming out, but all of my sort of writing proper time is focused on getting the PhD underway. So I've started the analysis of the films now. So I've done all of the background.
Can you tell us what you're trying to prove?
I can tell you broadly.
Yeah,
it's an investigation into Indigenous American and First Nations horror cinema.
Oh, wow.
It's a very small body of film, but it's growing. And I think that's part of the appeal for me, is that there's these films from the past two decades or so that are there and existing.
Yeah.
And as they're sort of slowly getting acknowledged and recognised for what's going on in them, there's a sort of a knock-on effect of more sort of young Indigenous American and First Nations filmmakers out there sort of going, oh, I'm really engaged with that. I'm really interested in that. And that sort of coincides with things like the Predator prequel, Prey.
They're
absolutely fantastic TV series, which isn't horror, but it's got some horror elements in it. Reservation Dogs, which is absolutely fabulous and has got the truly brilliant character of Dear Lady in it, who is just this phenomenal presence, supernatural presence throughout the whole of the three series. She doesn't necessarily haunt the series, but she's there. And when she has her sort of narrative exposed for one whole episode in series three, it's heartbreaking, but it's also just incredibly written and incredibly directed by Danis Gillette. Absolutely. Just top-notch television. So, yeah, it's opening me up to a whole kind of new world of horror and perceiving horror and looking at horror. So, yeah, it's brilliant. Love it.
Amazing. Well, look, best of luck with that. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.